Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, Episode 10, for March 7th, 2008. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me, as always. I've got a huge show for you today. Big show. It's a little later than normal getting this one out, I'm afraid, but it's partly because I've been traveling a bit, and one of my destinations was the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, and I'm going to report on that in this podcast. I'm not going to do news or anything like that. You know, everyone's already covered that, the blogs and news sites and other podcasts. You know, there are a lot of announcements and a lot of games that are pumped and hyped, and all of the major console makers and PC people, everybody's releasing all this stuff. I'm not going to cover any of that. My assumption is that you probably already have heard all that stuff. I hope to bring a little bit of a different perspective on GDC, in that I attended as an academic. You know, obviously I'm a college professor, and most of the people who attend the conference are game developers, you know, people who make games. And that's really the fun of it for me, is being among people who basically aren't like me. There are college professors who attend, but by and large, you know, they teach programming, or they teach game design courses, or specific skills related to building games. And so they're very directly connected to the industry. And I'm obviously not. I approach it from quite a different perspective. And it gave me a way of experiencing GDC and looking at it that I really appreciated. And hopefully I can bring that to you a little bit in this podcast. It was just an action-packed, event-filled 3 days that I was there, and so much to report on. So hopefully this will be interesting to you. And I got to tell you, it was a transformative event for me in a variety of ways, from the people that I met to the things that I saw, and you know, the kind of the proximity that I had to all kinds of really interesting design ideas and principles and roundtable discussions and all kinds of really cool stuff. Just some thoughts on that. That'll be one segment. In my second segment, I have an interview with Corvus Elrod, a really great guy. I've come to know him really prior to GDC, just through correspondence and visiting each other's blogs. And then I met him at GDC, and we had dinner, and you know, it was a really terrific interaction. And I thought it would be useful to interview him here for a couple of reasons. One, I like talking to bloggers who think hard about video games. I did that in my last podcast. And I want to continue to do that. But the other thing is, you know, I think a lot of what I do with the blog and the podcast is talk about games from a narrative perspective, games that tell stories and present characters and, you know, connect to my own training and interest in theater and film. And that's really what he does. Corvus is a storyteller, a professional storyteller, and he helps designers build stories and create narratives that are suitable to the games that they're working on. Very interesting guy, lots of really cool stuff to talk about, and I think you'll enjoy that interview. And finally, in the last segment, I have some listener email, and I have a listener MP3 file, and I'm going to spread a little blogger love here on the podcast and let you know about a couple of blogs that I think are really cool, and they're rather new. You may not have heard about them, and I intend to remedy that here. So that's the podcast, and away we go. So I attended the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, and I mentioned in the intro that this was a transformative event for me, and really, I'm not overstating it. I've been playing games since I was a kid, and I suppose most of you have, and this was the first time that I'd been in the presence of the people who make these games en masse. You know, everybody's there. Japanese designers less so. I think the Tokyo Game Show and other events maybe are more of a focus for them. But certainly when it comes to Western designers and in particular American designers and developers, GDC is the must-attend event of the year. And I think the numbers were something like 15,000 to 18,000 people, which is extraordinary. And I have a few impressions I want to just convey to you. But before I do, I have to say, you know, I've been going to conferences for a long time as a professional in my area, which is, as I've said, theater and film. And I've presented papers at conferences. And, you know, you have your national conference every year that you attend. And they're both called conferences, right? I mean, I go to an American Theater and Higher Education conference, and the game developers have their conference. And other than the fact that they're both called conferences, there's almost nothing similar about the two. They're completely different events. And I mean, there are some obvious things. You know, when you go to an academic conference, people deliver papers, and you know, people come to an academic conference with very, very specific areas of specialization, and it's sometimes their only chance to meet with people who really are focused on that along with them, people who they have no opportunity to meet or to see at any time of the year. So if you're interested in, you know, French cinema of a particular vintage and a particular set of filmmakers that you know, really are doing a kind of scholarly study of, it's the place that you'll meet the five other people in the world who are interested in that topic, and you can really exchange resources and talk and, you know, just relax and have fun too. That's part of what you do at a conference. And but you know, you go to these events in my discipline and you kind of sit there quietly and you listen to the papers delivered. And quite frankly, you know, it's a highly, highly esoteric, arcane kind of series of subjects that you'll encounter at these conferences. And, you know, to be honest with you, there is a life that these conferences have taken on, which has really nothing to do with the academic side. It's has a lot more to do with, you know, just meeting and greeting and getting back together with people you went to grad school with. And, you know, you might attend a few papers and you'll deliver your own paper. But, you know, to be completely frank, most people don't go to these conferences with a long list of paper topics that they're, you know, dying to hear delivered and that they're going to attend, you know, this one followed by this one, followed by this one, and, you know, 4 days straight. And it's just, at least my experience with conferences, that's not really what you do. But GDC is a totally different picture. You know, my plate was so full of events and roundtables and presentations and lectures and all these other kinds of things all going on at the same time. I think there were certain slots where I had literally like five or six different sessions that I was actively interested in attending. And I just couldn't because they were all at the same hour. I mean, it's just a completely jam-packed event. And people go to these events, these particular sessions, with a rabid interest in the subject. And unlike, say, at my academic conference where, you know, because these interest sessions tend to be very, very nichey, you know, that you might have five or six people show up at your paper, or, you know, if you're lucky, maybe 15 or 20, or if you're a big star, you know, you might get more. But at these, I went to a session on resolving conflict in video games without the use of violence. In particular, you know, how do you design a game that resolves a conflict without, you know, blowing away your enemy, basically, which is, you know, sort of standard game design 101. And that room was meant for, you know, maybe 25 people at the most, with a table kind of sitting around round table style. And I walk in and there's no place to sit. There's no place to stand. It's jam-packed. There's at least 75 to 100 people in that room, all there to talk about this particular issue. And every session that I'm aware of was like that. So part of what I discovered at GDC was, you know, it was kind of a snapshot for me of an industry at a certain place and time. And in my discipline, you know, we've been doing this forever and we'll continue to do it forever. And we get together and we have these meetings. But at GDC, you get the sense that people kind of feel that we're on the precipice of something important, that video games, interactive media, casual games, hardcore games, you know, all the different categories, that we're really at a place where some incredibly exciting things are happening. And these people who have their hands in this are, in very real ways, pioneers. And I think they're aware that they're pioneers. You know, they're moving forward in an industry where, you know, every week it seems like, or every month, there's some, you know, really cool new thing that's discovered, either in terms of a game design or principles of design discussions being held within a development house or among developers or at a conference like this. People, you know, tossing around real big ideas, not niche-y little things. I mean, of course, those things happen too. There are, you know, very specific kinds of issues that are discussed. But, you know, it's much more likely at GDC that you're going to have big conversations about where do we go next? Who are we? What are we doing? What is our audience? What should video games be delivering that they're not? How do we define ourselves in a way that is unique to us? And, you know, with connections to film, with connections to theater, with connections to other media, let's say, but not of them, separate from them. What can we borrow from them, but not become subsumed by them? And how can we develop a critical perspective on games? How do we talk about games in a rigorous, disciplined way that isn't, you know, kind of mired in the fanboy forum posting kind of discourse of video games that many people are familiar with? And, you know, these are primitive, fundamental, you know, really exciting questions. And you feel when you're at GDC that you're kind of in the middle of this big conversation that really matters. And I got to tell you, it's tremendously exciting. Now, having said that, I also have to observe something that was somewhat concerning to me and a little disappointing to be honest. And I'm probably sticking my neck out a little bit here because I wouldn't presume to speak for anyone here but myself. Part of my big response to GDC was the feeling that I had that the developers themselves, the people who are doing the real hardcore building and designing and coding, you know, the people who have their sleeves rolled up, I just really developed a deep affection for them. You know, they aren't very jaded, believe it or not. They, you know, some are, sure, and some of them, you know, are cynical, whatever. But by and large, they really are pretty bright-eyed, interesting people who really are trying their hardest to do a good job, and they really are interested in new ideas. They're not closed down in the ways that some people in other industries might be said to be. They're aware that they're involved in an art form that's evolving. But I talked to quite a few bloggers and journalists there as well, and I got to tell you, I was so disappointed by just the general level of cynicism and dark, bitter sensibility that seemed to just kind of be shared among all these people who are writing about video games. It's just odd. I don't know how to describe it, but it's like there's this kind of professional, detached, somewhat contemptuous, self-important air that you're supposed to adopt when you become a games blogger or a games journalist. And I'm not going to name any names or anything like that, but everybody was there. You know, all the big sites were there that you would know about if you follow games and read games news and blogs and journalism on the internet. And I got to tell you, I don't disparage people on this podcast. I try to make a real practice of not tearing anybody down, but you know, there's some real jerks among these guys. They're almost all guys, by the way, and they're just terribly self-important, kind of unfriendly people who really just are kind of no fun to be around. And I don't quite understand that. I did speak to a few people about it and, you know, observing it really up close for the first time. And a couple of friends suggested to me that maybe it's because this particular group doesn't yet have a voice in the industry and that they still sort of feel like outsiders and they're looking for a way in. And because they don't have that way in, and because in some ways, bloggers and journalists are not they're not welcomed in a sense by the industry because we don't really talk the same language, and because maybe we're perceived as, you know, basically our whole function is, you know, 5.3 is your score, or 9.2, or, you know, 5 stars or whatever, that our only real function is to just grade them on these games. And, you know, we can do that in 10 minutes, even though they spent 3 years building this game. So, you know, I could see where there's a certain tension, but, you know, that makes sense to me as an explanation to a certain degree. But I got to tell you, you know, I wanted to grab some of these guys, and, you know, I'm a little older than most of them. And I just wanted to say, look, just grow up, you know, why don't you lose the attitude, and why don't you have some fun? This is a pretty amazing thing you're involved with here. And you could probably do with a little less smugness. But anyway, there's my mini rant, other than the bloggers and journalists. And by the way, many exceptions, you know, some really wonderful people that I met, Steve Gaynor and Corvus, who I'll interview here in a minute, and several others aren't like that at all. And so please don't misunderstand me. But the people that attended the conference, that are reporting on the conference, and that are bringing you the news of the conference that you're receiving on the internet, well, anyway, I've told you how I feel about what I saw, and I guess I'll move on. One of the most exciting things about GDC for me was the Independent Game Festival. And the exhibition hall has a certain area set up where these games are featured. And you can, and this is the coolest part, you can walk up to the games, get your hands on them, play them, take a look at them. But standing there next to the game is the developer. And these are students, in most cases, although not all, and they're really unbelievably clever, inventive people who are really just over the top exuberant about what they're doing. And their stuff is pretty damned amazing. Let me tell you, there were 30 of these games featured. And one of the things that becomes apparent to you at GDC is that independent gaming and the tool sets that are available to create these games for people who are really just entering the industry are really robust, and they enable you to do some pretty amazing things. So the games that you see in the independent game area, you know, they look like what state-of-the-art games would have looked like only a few years ago. They really are beautiful graphically. They have tremendous physics systems involved where, you know, you really get this sense that you're controlling a player that has weight and that the environment has a physical kind of reality to it. And, you know, a couple things I want to note that I really thought were terrific about this particular collection of games and developers. One is the kind of fanciful sense that I got from them. A spirited notion that these are games, folks, so don't ask me to create some photorealistic depiction of New York City and, you know, make that your gaming environment. I'm taking nothing against, you know, I'm sure that Grand Theft Auto 4 is going to be an amazing rendition of New York City and people are going to love that. But you know, these designers are really, really mining their imaginations. And in some cases, what they're coming up with is, to me anyway, significantly more interesting than the mainstream stuff I see coming out from the major developers and studios. I'm going to list a few of them on the website. I won't go into them here because it's kind of hard to describe a game with words, you know, in audio format. But I will link you in the show notes to the podcast is some of the games that I was most excited about. For now, I'll just give you a couple of titles. One of them, which is right up my alley because it has a real silent film vibe, is a little game called The Misadventures of P.B. Winterbottom. And it's a platformer, but it's a lot more than that. It is a game that plays with time. And that was a theme I saw in a lot of these independent games, games that kind of mess with chronology and, you know, give you the opportunity to sort of do something and then record that and then back up and do it again. And your recorded version remains part of the gameplay. So you're interacting with what you just did before that. And then that gets layered with another and another. And suddenly there are 5 versions of you all recorded from actions that you were doing previously, and you need those characters to do little things for you to enable you to succeed in a certain level. So it sounds very complex, and actually it is, but it's also a hell of a lot of fun. And this particular game has this whole grainy kind of early English silent film vibe to it. It has this sense that the film is distressed, that like they dragged this reel of film out of a dumpster somewhere and, you know, did what they could to kind of piece it back together. And it turns out that inside this old movie is this fun game you can play. It's not a terrific description. I mean, you should definitely go to the website and check it out. But for me, that was one of the highlights, and I really enjoyed meeting the developers of that game. A couple of other titles, and I'll just mention them. Crayon Physics Deluxe, which won the award for best game at the design competition. A game called Cursor Times 10, which is, I think it's just a flash game, but it was shown to me at the Experimental Games Seminar, which was really cool. They kind of blew through a bunch of these games, which may not necessarily even be full games with a full, complete design around them, but more a kind of an exhibition of game ideas. So, you know, here's a piece of a game that would really be cool in the context of a larger game if you wanted to use this trick or this little technique. And then another couple of games by a designer named Rod Humble, a game that some people are familiar with. It came out some time ago called The Marriage, and his newest one called Stars Over Half Moon Bay. These games are very self-conscious attempts at rendering an artistic experience, both visually but also through gameplay. And again, I'm not going to go too far into them because especially in the case of these two games, they really defy description in a certain way. You need to play them. I'll put links on the website and you can go to them and enjoy. The other thing, other than just a kind of wonderful, imaginative, spirited sense of play and really a kind of a subversive design strain that I saw through these games. The other thing I saw was an odd embrace of games. Well, not odd. I mean, exciting, but odd in the sense that it's so rare today. An embrace of games that aren't violent. These games, by and large, that I saw, these 30 games in the independent section, these games were mostly platformers. There were some Half-Life mods, but, you know, really fanciful ones. But no shooters. I think there may have been only one or two shooters in the bunch. And I talked to a couple of designers about, you know, why aren't there guns? Why isn't there shooting? Are you sort of consciously deciding to move away from that? Is that a personal thing, a political thing? I got pretty much the same answer from each one. And it was, no, we're just bored with them. You know, we're doing games that we want to do because nobody's doing them. And this is what we want to play. We don't need more shooters. We know what those do. And nothing against them. Shooters can be cool. Come up with a new mechanic and we'll try it and maybe it'll make them fun again. But for right now, we're sort of bored with shooters. And the tool sets that we have allow us to make these games that do some things that are, to these designers, much more interesting than shooting things. And these series of mechanics that they're exploring in these games, playing with time, playing with physics, playing with giving you control over physics, all kinds of cool little mechanics that you can implement into a game that don't, in fact, have anything to do with shooting things, turn out to be, in my opinion, really what the cutting edge of game design looks like right now, at least among these indie developers. And as we all know, you know, indie developers, indie filmmakers, indie small theater companies, you name it, these are the people who fuel innovation. These are the people who show us, oftentimes, not always, but they often show us, you know, what's possible, where we could go if we wanted to. And we really, really have to keep our eye on these young designers, because as far as I could tell, I mean, there were times when you couldn't even get near these people. The area was packed, and you could go over to the Sony area where they were showing, you know, Warhawk or whatever, you know, several different games running, Gran Turismo, and you could just walk up and play them when there weren't too many people around. Nintendo was pretty busy, especially Wii Fit, and Smash Brothers was, you know, jacked with people. But I would say by far the busiest area of that exhibition floor was the independent games area. And I talked to one of the developers near the end of the day, and she just looked shell-shocked. I mean, she had spoken to so many people and given away so many little postcards, you know, with their web address. And I mean, she was completely spent. And when you look around at each of the other developers, they all pretty much look the same. It must have been, you know, a terribly, terribly exhausting experience for them. But having said that, you know, they were having a great time. And I really enjoyed the Independent Games Festival area of GDC. Just a couple of other quick notes on GDC. I attended a game preservation roundtable, and there's a post on the blog about this, and I recommend that you go there. I go into quite a bit more detail, but you know, there are four universities and the Library of Congress and people from development studios and, you know, all over the world involved in trying to put together a coherent effort to archive and preserve the history of this medium. And now's the time to do that, because as we know with film, and you know, there was no effort to really think about this or consider preserving old films until long after it was too late. And we've lost upwards of 50 to 75% of all the silent films that were ever made as a result of really two factors. One, the films were shot on nitrate film, which is highly flammable and has this horrible capacity for self-combustion. Not a good thing. And of course, the other reason is because people just didn't think those films were worth anything. They weren't saved because no one thought to save them, unfortunately. We're now at a place where it's not too late for us to do the right thing with the history of video games. And this is a big effort, and I'm happy to support it and happy to be involved in it in whatever way I can, and I hope that you will too. Lastly, this is just for me, basically. I got to meet my old hero, Steve Moretzky. I've mentioned him on this podcast before, and I've written about his game, A Mind Forever Voyaging, on the blog. And I was very, very pleased and delighted to be able to meet him at GDC and shake his hand and tell him personally how much I've admired his work and how much it's meant to me. And of course, as you might expect, he was a very pleasant guy, a very nice fellow, and was happy to talk to me. And, you know, I was also delighted that he won the Game Designers Challenge, which is an annual event at GDC where they kind of pitch a game challenge at like three or four different big-time designers, famous designers, and they have like 6 hours to come up with a whole game design. And Moretzky won it this year. No surprise, he's a genius. But anyway, it was a thrill to meet him, and it kind of wrapped up GDC for me in the most perfect way. So I hope that you've enjoyed this little snapshot of my experience at GDC. I'm grateful for the opportunity to go. I know that a whole bunch of you would probably like to have been there, and you couldn't for any number of reasons. And believe me, I don't for a minute take it for granted that I was able to go. My employer sent me, basically, and I'm grateful to them for doing that. It was quite an experience. I want to thank Corvus Elrod for joining me for this edition of The Brainy Gamer. And if you are interested in storytelling, Corvus is the guy you need to know, because he is very focused on the topic of storytelling and video games. And his blog, Man Bites Blog, which I love, by the way, cool name, is a must-visit site for you. You should bookmark it and make sure that it's in your Google Reader or whatever subscriber you use for RSS feeds, because it's really terrific, and he's very diligent about posting and staying on top of things. And Corvus, I just want to thank you and welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So I want to begin by talking about your blog, Man Bites Blog, and if you could just give me a little background on how you started it and kind of what your focus is.
I started Man Bites Blog about 3 years ago now. I think I'm actually coming up on my 3 year anniversary this month at some point. I was unemployed in a small town and had gone through some other personal things, which I've hinted at here and there on the blog, but don't need to get into now. And I was really, really depressed. And I was worried that I would not maintain connections with the outside world, given the environment I was currently in. So I decided I would start blogging, and that would be a good quantifiable thing I could do every day. I mandated that I would post at least a sketch a day during the weekdays, and it just sort of took off and has almost taken over.
Have you always been interested in storytelling, not just regarding games, but storytelling in general?
Yes. When I look back at the overriding patterns of my life, which, by the way, is what I consider storytelling to be, looking at and describing overriding patterns, I've been a storyteller since I was 3 or 4. One of my earliest memories is of standing in a window watching trees getting bulldozed down in the empty lot next to my house, and holding my shoulders and my hips and saying how much it hurt, which was my means even then as a 3-year-old in Metairie, Louisiana, of expressing sort of the story of the emotional impact that watching these trees get bulldozed had upon me.
You internalized it.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it something that you found yourself doing at an early age with video games? Did you play video games and find yourself connecting to story? Or was there a video game that you recall kind of hooked you in that way and made you think about story?
It's been a gradual process, I think. I've done a lot of like acting and directing and improvisational comedy, improvisational drama. I've had a lot more traditional storytelling experience, but video games slowly crept into the picture over the course of many years. And I'd say that my passion for bringing, I've also done a lot of role playing. And so that was decidedly informed, like tabletop, using my own system, was really informed my storytelling exploration for a very long time. It's probably within the last 5 or 6 years that my focus has really turned towards video games as being something that's a potentially powerful storytelling medium.
It's interesting to me. There's a fair number of us who came to video games from a different place, you know, maybe from the theater or from an interest in performing in some way. And, you know, certainly that's how I came to it as well. But there is a kind of a cross-section that I think you are focusing on, and I find myself drawn to it. It's why I came to your blog in the first place. It's that intersection between storytelling, participation, connection between performer and audience, audience as, in a way, audience as that element which completes that circle in a way. That's one of the things that you're most interested in, right?
Yes, very much so. Long ago, became more enamored of other people to tell their stories and helping them find those overriding patterns and themes within their lives and their experience, and then describing those in ways that were empowering to them. People come to video games expecting to be able to control them and bring their own experience to them.
So that there are certain elements of theater as performance, theater as a way of communicating that, in your view, video games are capable of doing, or capable of doing differently or better, or what's the relationship between the two from your point of view?
Ultimately better, I think. If we look at theater as very traditional theater, the way your audience responds to an unfolding performance can really have a dramatic impact on the way the actors perform. If the audience is very appreciative of the humor, you'll find that a cast starts to automatically leave some space for laughter, really punch up the jokes. But if the audience is there to weep at the poignancy of character relationships, those scenes become more emphasized within the unfolding of the play. And that's not always a conscious decision. It just sort of happens as the shared energy gets built. I've worked on a sort of immersive improvisational level to do sort of guerrilla theater on a one-on-one basis, where within a 30-second experience, the audience has almost complete control over the unfolding of a very quick interaction, and then boom, I'm gone. Mm-hmm. What video games do is it allows your audience to sit there for a long period of time and control interaction after interaction after interaction, which ultimately can build into that participatory nature. If you're actually providing them with that sort of control over the story, they develop a relationship with the game.
Obviously, there's an interactive element, but it's not simply interactive. It's also participatory, and that's a very different thing.
Yes. I've described it a lot of different ways on the blog over the years. You can go up and interact with a bank teller you've never seen before, and you can have a successful interaction or a non-successful interaction. But when you go to the same bank day after day after day, and you see the same teller day after day after day, each of those individual interactions becomes a relationship and becomes an ongoing and building emotional experience, which I consider to be a participation.
Right.
It's got a deeper emotional quotient than a mere clinical interaction.
Now, your project, you're building an engine that will enable players to essentially do what you're describing, have these kinds of participatory interactive experiences with the game, with each other. Could you describe kind of where that project is and where you want to go with it and what that experience would feel like to me as a player?
Where it is it's in its very initial stages. It's a handful of Python scripts with a command line interface at the moment. It's all designed to sort of start replicating the base components of the role-playing system that I've developed over the past 18 years. And what it's going to grow into eventually, and this is going to be a very long eventually because I'm the only storyteller / artist / programmer on the project, and I'm not looking for funding for it, it is a perpetual online world which highlights the true elements of drama, which are not characters as individuals, but character relationships. So by providing the same type of narrative feedback that I do in my tabletop gaming, players should be able to create emotionally satisfying and meaningful experiences for themselves within the context of a community.
So the game would provide, I mean, I'm thinking of tabletop gaming here, and you've got, you know, the game master, for example, who's sort of pushing things along with spinning a tale, basically, that he has a picture of in his head and that the players can kind of gradually discover as they go along. Does the game provide that kind of dynamic?
Let me provide a little context in the way I run participatory storytelling sessions. You used the word push, I believe, there. That a game master typically sort of shepherds a group of players through an established scenario that they have in mind. And I take a very different approach. I design an environment with consistent rules, both social and physical rules and magical rules. And then I allow the players free rein. I give them a context for which they interact with the system, and then I give them free rein to do whatever they want.
So basically this person, I mean, it's an interesting term, isn't it? Game master.
Yes.
This person would in a way sort of function as a game conduit that we
right.
create these pathways for the players.
Right. Would allow the players. And then what I do as the meta storyteller, the primary storyteller, is I do have characters that are trying to accomplish things on their own, usually very grandiose, world-changing things. And the players will get caught up in those actions, but how they choose to react to them and whether they choose to become involved with them at all is entirely up to the players.
So the world could, I mean, when we think about tabletop gaming, we often think of, you know, kind of high fantasy environments or whatever. Right. Am I understanding it properly? If, you know, depending on the group of people around the table, the environment could be anything, and it could be futuristic, or it could be, you know, very connected to now and here. The game could be flexible too. It's not environmentally specific to any certain kind of Dungeons and Dragons rule set 2.4, that sort of thing.
Right. The rule set I've created is designed to really get out of the way of the storytelling process, but still provide a measure of randomness and chance and risk. I've tried diceless systems, and I've tried practically ruleless systems, and players don't tend to take their characters seriously if there's no risk of losing the characters.
Exactly.
I'm curious about your story studio. Now, help me if I'm pronouncing this wrong. Zaklero?
Yes.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about what you do and how that works?
Yeah. Right now, through Zaklero Story Studio, I'm primarily writing for video games. I work with Pogo.com with an ongoing monthly game they have called Jigsaw Detective. I'm actually working with Moo.com on a fun egg hunt they're doing right now. It just started launch today, actually. And I've got a game that'll be released soon that was developed by Pobros Incorporated, which is another casual gaming studio that I did the writing for it. I'm also hoping to start working with smaller studios on interpreting their games, the video games and their game mechanics, as storytelling themselves. So not even so much doing the writing for them, but helping them strengthen the storytelling potential that's already inherent within the game design that they've created.
So a company might have a general idea of an approach they'd like to take, but they need someone to help them kind of form it into something that has a structure that makes sense in terms of narrative.
Right. Strengthen it narratively.
Right.
Precisely.
Right. Now, I'm interested because you make some interesting distinctions that connect to some of the things I do teaching dramaturgy in the theater, and that is you kind of break out narrative, plot, and story, and suggest that they're three very different things. They're connected, but they're three different things. And I think when most people hear those three words, narrative, plot, story, that it's all the same thing. They're interchangeable, but not the way you see it.
I've really pushed to come up with some better clarity, because a lot of people argue that video games don't tell stories because stories are these intrinsically linear things that happen. But if you read some essays by Umberto Eco, or you read any of the Russian folklorists, you'll find that it's quite possible to think of story as being this experience of reading something, or having participated in something, as I like to say, because you participate with a book. You fill in blanks and gaps. The characters that are compelling to you aren't necessarily because of what's directly written on the page, but what you assume about them based upon what's written on the page.
Absolutely.
And it's only after you've interacted with that narrative that you really have a story. It gets built as you participate with it. And then when it's done, that's when you've got your story. So story is almost sort of a retrospective. It's the emotional journey you took while interacting with the narrative. And to me, that gives story a lot more of the social power that I feel it really has, and makes it something that really focuses on the audience's experience, which is what storytelling is all about. You might write a novel for yourself, but if you're hoping for that novel to tell a compelling story, it's really all about the audience's experience of your novel.
Right, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you think about how, if we all read the same book, or all played the same game, or whatever, we could, and what you're saying wasn't true, then ultimately we would just recount the plot, and we would agree, yes, those things happened, then we would move on. There'd be nothing left to talk about, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm curious about that, how that works for you with video games, and, you know, examples that you might have from recent times, or even back when you first started playing games, of a gaming experience that provided this experience for you, that really, you know, gave you that kind of engagement, that made a story emerge that seemed to speak to you, that was unique to you, that made an impact on you.
Sure. I'm going to steer that in a slightly more illustrative fashion, I think, and talk about Portal, because A, it's a very recent example that people will be very familiar with, and also it's very illustrative of why I separate narrative from story. My wife, who is not a video gamer with as much history as I have, although she obsessively plays on her DS and loves the Wii, but she typically hasn't done first-person shooters, but because there was a Jonathan Coulton song in the credits, wanted to complete Portal on her own. So I stepped back and I did not play it and just let her play through it at her pace and watched her emotional interaction with the game as it trained her how to navigate a 3D environment from a first person perspective and did a really great job of it, and watched her have emotional reactions to Gladys's taunting and had my own emotional reactions as I was playing it. But I also, she played a lot when I wasn't there, and then I talked to her about it afterwards, and she developed some compassion for the companion cube, and she was really sort of creeped out once you get behind the scenes later in the game and absolutely couldn't deal with the last portion of the game because of her stress level at that point.
Yeah.
So I sit down to play it, and I'm pretty cynical about computers that talk to me in games because I played System Shock and have been taunted by Shodan. And Shodan is far, far creepier than GLaDOS ultimately.
The creepiest, I think. I think Shodan's the creepiest character that I've ever come across in a video game.
Yeah, she's brilliant. Her execution was fantastic in System Shock. So I played it with deep cynicism, and when I was told to love the companion cube, I didn't. I solved all the puzzles very efficiently because I'm already pretty familiar with how to navigate 3D environments and didn't have to spend time getting oriented, and breezed through the final level laughing at the relative ineffectiveness of GLaDOS to be anywhere near as scary as she was trying to be. Hmm. And so we each had these very different emotional interactions by playing the same narrative, which led us along the same plot, had the same structure. I wasn't able to change which level I did next or rearrange what GLaDOS said to me through dialogue trees or anything else. But the game itself got completely out of my way and allowed me to have whatever emotional experience I wanted.
Fascinating.
As well as my wife having the same complete freedom, and we had very different experiences.
And there's your evidence, right? Just what you were talking about before. My wife is, I would describe her as a gamer that's very similar to yours. I find myself sometimes, Portal would be a great example of how this happens, where, you know, if she's willing to get her hands on a game like that and, you know, she'll get deep enough into it, I have this overwhelming sort of feeling like, you see how great these video games can be? Like, do you get it now? Do you see? And she does. I mean, I had a similar experience with her with this little game called Aquaria, which I've written about. And, you know, it's not nearly as rich in thematically or whatever as Portal, but you know, there's a lot going on there, and it's almost evangelical, I would say, my love of being able to sort of put someone in front of a game, and if they're open to it, show them, prove to them in a certain kind of way that these video games can be very compelling experiences.
Right.
Well, I want to talk about one more thing about your work and your blog, and that's something you call Blogs of the Round Table.
Yes.
Which is, I think, a terrific idea. Could you describe what that is and kind of how that came about?
Blogs of the Roundtable is a centralized topic that I post on the first or around the first of every month and invite people on their own blogs to hold forth on the topic. It's really designed, my intent is for that to turn into a large ongoing conversation for the month between multiple blogs. It's a way to sort of connect with other bloggers and not feel so much like a crazy person shouting in the wilderness. And helps me find focus sometimes, particularly in the early days. I was sort of looking for an identity for the blog, and people really liked it when I got my rant on. And so I tried to pick topics where I could really get my rant on and hopefully ruffle a few feathers and really get some good conversation started. Yeah. And it's proven to be really popular. And every time I'm considering shutting it down, I get linked to from somewhere that says, we've always really enjoyed reading the Roundtable because it's a good way to find quality content spread across multiple blogs. And then I was always, oh, wow, that's really great. I can't give up on it now. It's a lot of fun. And I always marvel at how many different perspectives can be brought to a topic and how many intelligent bloggers there are out there that are really thinking. And some of them, a lot of my participants are video gamers, not video game developers. And they really rise to the challenge of some of these topics. We've talked about everything from whether genre is useful to one particularly memorable topic was game addiction, where we had some really touching personal stories about people's struggle with life balance between video gaming and family and career.
Well, it touches on something that I think what really drew me to your blog and you know, frankly, to you personally, and we've talked about this, you know, kind of one-on-one, is that it, what you're doing, I think, is you're doing a lot of community building. You're thinking about how to bring people together to talk about things rather than each of us shouting from our own little individual mountaintops. Yeah. And you're thinking about this more broadly, too, you know, thinking about game developers, bloggers, the whole community, and finding ways for us to not only sort of connect, but to talk to each other and kind of learn each other's language in a certain way.
Yes. Yeah. You know, really, when it comes right down to it, I firmly believe that there are two social tools that are vital to our survival as a culture. And I'm talking about not just the video game culture, but all culture. One is play, and one is stories. And they're both tools used to bring communities together and help us figure out how to survive and thrive. And it's a huge, and at times it feels like almost sacred, responsibility to be involved with one of those, much less trying to bring them both together.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I admire you for it. I truly do. And I think especially, I don't mean to be too cynical, but you know, it doesn't take much surfing around the web on game sites to sort of get the sense that really all we want to do is just kind of scream at each other and pound our fists on the table and, you know, defend our sort of fanboy points of view. Forums can be just really incredibly hostile and ugly places.
Yes.
And
yes.
You know, you were swimming upstream in a certain kind of really noble, admirable way, and I really admire it, and I appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, I wrap this segment up each time with a question, which I'm calling the Last Supper game. And it has to do with that one game that you could play if you knew that it would be the last game you ever got to play. So do you have one?
You know, I've struggled. I knew you were going to ask this question, and I've struggled with it. I really wish you'd ask me James Lipton's follow-up questions instead. I've given a lot of thought to this, and the answer that I've come up with sort of surprised me, because while I really enjoyed the game, it's not one that I would have initially thought that I want to be the last game that I'll ever play. But the game that I've decided on is The Legend of Zelda Wind Waker.
Oh, I love you.
And there's multiple reasons for this. First of all, I think that the sailing metaphor in the game is very apt for setting off on your last sort of game adventure before death. That's one reason. The second reason is it is so charming and sweet and completely underscores the theme of what I consider to be really the central theme of all Zelda games, which is the triumph of youthful innocence and delight over the cynical, power-mongering forces of adulthood. And I can't imagine a better sort of spirit to carry with me across that final threshold into the great unknown.
That's awesome. That is so cool. One of us needs to think about or write about or get a round table about the virtues of Zelda thematically. You so succinctly wrapped it up, I mean, it perfectly for me, what's charming about that game. And there are all kinds of other interesting strains. I mean, they're all very environmentally conscious games. When you think about what you do, you know, trying to prevent a tree from dying, you know, trying to understand how the wind or the water works in such a way to in a way serve its needs, which is a theme that kind of plays through all those Zelda games.
Yes.
There's all kinds of really wonderful stuff there.
Yeah, that is. I'll have to take that under advisement. I've got a couple people pestering me for the next roundtable topic, but I think I may have to move that one up to the top of the queue.
Well, the cool thing about Zelda is if you throw it out there, you're probably going to get 700 people wanting to participate.
That would be awesome. I would love that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending time with me and chatting with me. And just on a personal note, you know, I went to GDC this year and sort of didn't know a soul. And, you know, I'm an academic who's not very connected to developers. And you helped me to understand how it all works and introduced me to some people. And you were just very kind to me. And I'm really grateful for that. You're a terrific guy. And I appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Okay. Well, Corvus, take care and best of luck with Man Bites blog and all of your other work.
Thank you very much. Same to you. I look forward to continue reading Brainy Gamer, and I think you've actually inspired me to start up my own podcast here within the next week or two.
Excellent. Ooh. So you're making that announcement here?
Yep. There we go. It's officially announced here. I will be starting a podcast.
Cool. I love it. Well, again, thanks for your time and best of luck.
Thanks, Michael.
Hello listeners, I'm Matty J and I'm a contributor over at DanielPrime.com, a small video game blog which specializes around general and nostalgic themed articles. So if you have the time, please feel free to take a look at DanielPrime.com. Enjoy the rest of the podcast.
So thanks again to Corvus for that interview. I enjoyed it very much and I hope you did too. The little promo that you heard just a second ago is for a website called Daniel Primed, and the link is on the show notes for this podcast. What you'll find there is a nice combination of writing on games that are emerging now, trends, design principles, but also some retro stuff. And he's a gamer who's interested in older games and makes some interesting connections between older and new, and also seems to have a particularly fine eye for the Nintendo stuff. He certainly covers everything else, but his Nintendo writing and his history with Nintendo games seems to be pretty strong. And so head on over there. I think you'll enjoy it. He's an interesting guy, a nice guy, and very astute, and I think you'll enjoy his blog. I also received a message recently from another blogger named Manvir Hare. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Manvir. He is a gameplay programmer for Raven Software, and he has begun a new blog, a very new blog, and it's called Design Rampage. And I want to recommend that one to you as well, because he is really all about game design, and obviously, that's a great interest of mine, and I write about it on the blog a lot. He writes it, of course, from a somewhat more firsthand perspective, given that he's a game designer. If you go there now, you'll find that he's writing about this game that I'm crazy about called Audio Surf. I posted a piece a while back on games that you can play with your kids that won't drive you crazy, and Audio Surf was one, which it's an amazingly wonderful game. I was so fortunate to be able to sit next to the designer, Dylan Fitterer, who created Audio Surf, at a dinner that Corvus, who I interviewed a minute ago, he invited me to, and I happened to be sitting next to Dylan. And, you know, I proceeded to spend the evening, you know, explaining to him why his game is so good. Not that he didn't know, but, you know, I had like 11 reasons that I thought he needed to memorize for why that game is so incredibly good. And of course, he agreed with everything I said. Anyway, what you'll find if you go over to Design Rampage, and again, the link is on the blog, is some really interesting pieces. He's written one on building community through what he calls information pushing, and it's a big part of how Audio Surf works in terms of its gameplay experience. And I think you'll enjoy his writing about that and about a number of other topics. He's really just launching this blog, and so I want to help give it a little bit of a push, and I hope you'll run over there and check it out. If you like Brainy Gamer, I think you'll like this one too. And also be sure to check out Daniel Primed. Finally, on the podcast, I'm going to take a look at a little bit of listener email. And as I've said before, I always answer your email, even if I can't get to it on the podcast. This time I had quite a few that I couldn't get to as part of the podcast, but you know, I think I've responded to almost all of them. And please feel free to keep sending those to me. I really enjoy receiving them. I received one just the other day from a fellow by the name of David, who has begun a new blog called Theory Fighter. And it's about a week old. I'll put the link on the blog as well in the show notes. And you should head over there and check it out. I think he's provoking me and a lot of other people, I think, to think about questions that have been floating around related to video games. But in some ways, he sees a certain kind of contradiction that no one has really pointed out very effectively yet. And he puts it to me in a certain way, and I'll just read you his question. I'm not going to attempt to prove or disprove a link between virtual violence and aggressive behavior. However, I find it hypocritical for gamers to so quickly dispel the notion of violent games influencing violent behaviors, then simultaneously be on the forefront of the games are art movement. Art is a creative work that influences, whether that influence is positive or negative. Art engages its audience and instigates emotions and behaviors: excitement, dread, enjoyment, depression, courage, anxiety, loneliness, compassion, and yes, even aggression. If we are fighting so hard to get games recognized as art, then we must also accept the notion that games can influence violence. He asks me what my view is on this subject. Now, that's a terrific question. And I got to tell you, I've thought about this pretty much ever since he sent this to me. I've been thinking about this question because I know that I've written on the blog about being rather suspicious that there is any kind of provable link between violent video games or violence in video games and violent behavior. There seems to be a pretty contradictory pile of information about that that no one seems to be able to sort through and make complete sense out of. But I do believe that normalizing violence in our culture, which is something I think we've been doing for quite some time, does have a kind of a anesthetizing effect when it comes to our concern or our shock of when violence occurs, just generally. If we're so accustomed to violence as a regular part of our lives, whether it's virtual or not, it seems to me it's possible that we could become kind of inured to violence in ways that, you know, could harm us. Not necessarily it means that I'm going to go out and harm someone else with violence, but just it makes me less sensitive, less willing to be provoked to do something to stop violence or to help someone or to connect myself in any kind of emotional way to the needs of someone who's the victim of violence. But, you know, where he really gets me on this question is I'm certainly the first person that will say art matters. And the reason art matters is because it engages us, because it makes us see things and feel things. And it helps us understand better who we are, what it means to be a human being in the world. This is the role of art. And if that level of engagement, you know, works, if video games are capable of doing that to us, with us, then why can't they have an impact on us in terms of violence? I think, David, you know, you kind of put me on the spot here, and I obviously decided to include this in the podcast knowing that I really didn't have an answer. And I think kind of throwing it out there the way you have on your blog and me putting it on the podcast, it, you know, maybe the way we should go with this is to say, let's bring the community in on this. Let's think about this. I'll think about it. I'll make a post on my blog about it. And we'll continue this conversation with our community of readers and see if we can make some headway. To me, that's the whole point of this, right? I mean, we're interested in these video games, but, you know, not so that we can all just sort of jump up and down about how cool they are or, you know, or share our high scores with each other. We're interested in having some discourse connected to what these games do, what they mean, what impact they have, and how they speak to us. And, you know, you're pointing at something that provokes me to think I need to think more about this. So that's what I'm going to do. I hope you will too. And like I said, I hope to return to this question on my blog and we'll maybe connect up again. And who knows, maybe we can have a little cross-blog communication between the two of us and this conversation can be opened up to other people. So thanks for that question. Well, I'm looking at the clock and, I've been going a little too long, haven't I? Sorry, everybody. I'm just having too much fun. What can I do? I said I was going to do an MP3 file question, which, you know, I've been asking for an MP3 question for ages, and I finally got one, and now I'm not going to answer it. It's from my friend Dano. Dano, I'm going to answer it. I'm going to wait till the next podcast because I'm pretty much out of time, and I think I'm straining my listeners' willingness to stick with me probably. So, Dano, thanks for sending me that MP3 question. It's a really great question, by the way. I can't wait to talk about it, but I'll do it next podcast. So that'll bring you all back and, you know, leave you with a little cliffhanger and get you back on the next podcast. I do have, though, one last piece. This is by popular demand because of the last podcast. Some players received some useful advice on how to beat the final boss in Resident Evil 4, courtesy of my daughter Zoe. And so she's back this week in honor of Corvus's visit and the Wind Waker. This is some very, very good, strong advice on how to defeat Ganon at the end of The Wind Waker. So please, as last time, get out your pencils and get ready, because she's only going to tell you once. So pay attention. Okay, so I hope you got that, because I'm not playing it again. And she's not going to say it again. So hope you got it. I want to thank you all for listening. And I want to thank all of you for visiting the blog. I'm thinking by the next podcast that I will have reached 100,000 hits on the blog, which is mind-boggling to me. And I'm terribly, terribly grateful for all of you that have made the effort to come visit the Brainy Gamer. And I don't know what to say. It just puts a huge, huge smile on my face, and I thank you very much. I want to thank all of you for listening to the Brainy Gamer podcast. See you next time.